Sport der Wissenschaft. Ein Podcast rund um die Themen Sport und Gesundheit.
Hey, ich habe hier irgendwie eine neue Sportart entdeckt.
Gesundheit. Was ist das eigentlich? Wissen wir das nicht alle?
Spoiler. Mit den Widersprüchen der Zeit und der Gesellschaft auseinanderzusetzen.
Eine Initiative des Zentrums für Hochschulsport der Goethe-Universität Frankfurt. Und nun viel Spaß bei einer weiteren Folge von Sport der Wissenschaft.
Welcome to all listeners. My name is Sabrina and I'm a student assistant at the Center for University Sports in Goethe University Frankfurt. Today I'm very happy to introduce Dr. Amy Danich. He's a research fellow from Elliott Health Clinical Research Office in Melbourne. So welcome, Amy. So today's episode will be about physical activity in patients with cancer. So Amy's going to tell us about her PhD and how its scientific engagement can improve healthcare services and as well contribute to further studies. So yeah, maybe you can start with telling us more about your background.
Sure. So thanks for having me today, Sabrina. So I am a physiotherapist by background and still am a clinical physiotherapist, although most of my work is in research. So I've been a physio now for over 10 years and I started out doing rehabilitation and really enjoyed kind of working with patients to optimize their function and improve their quality of life. And this cancer journey that I've been on with my research started about probably 8 or more years ago now, where we were noticing more people come through with cancer through our services. And at about a similar time, we were getting more and more research about the benefits of exercise in cancer. And previously, patients were pretty much just told, oh, just rest, like you've got fatigue, just conserve your energy. But this research coming out was saying that exercise is actually really helpful for cancer-related fatigue and we should be getting these patients up and going. And at the same time, I had a personal connection with cancer. So my grandfather was diagnosed with cancer and he was told this advice to rest. And so that really sparked me wanting to know a little bit more about what we can do within physiotherapy and exercise. And I had a colleague encourage me to pursue a PhD. And I knew we had some really good researchers here within the hospital. And that's where I started my PhD journey. And I fell in love with working in the oncology space and the benefits that we can have for patients. And now I'm working still continuously exclusively in oncology, which I really love.
So in the Elliott Health Clinical Research Office, you only deal with like implementing rehab programs in patients with cancer, or do you think anything else?
Yeah, so for me personally, my research program is generally all about people with cancer. However, I do support other clinicians who might be working in the hospital with different areas of interest. So this can be people with other chronic diseases, like I've supported clinicians to do systematic reviews about people with stroke, treadmill training for Parkinson's disease, people with heart disease. And our research interests within our office that we work in at the hospital are quite broad. So our main themes of research relate to rehabilitation, people living at home for as long as they can, and also another area of research which is more from my colleagues about demand management and managing waiting lists and access to services. And my research kind of intersects the two, health service research and rehabilitation, because I'm interested not only in improving outcomes for people with cancer, but also how they can access services in a timely way as well.
So thank you for these insights. So what was your overall topic for in your PhD, and what made you, yeah, you already said like what you kind of why you're interested as well in your research. So yeah, what was your topic about?
Yeah, so my topic with my PhD really evolved over the 3.5 year period that I did my PhD. So it first started with looking at the optimal dose of exercise for people with cancer, because people think, oh, people have cancer, they should only do low intensity exercise. I thought, oh, I think the research might show that they can do a little bit more. So we started with doing a systematic review, which reinforced that these patients should be doing at least moderate intensity exercise to improve their symptoms, such as fatigue, but also to maybe improve inflammatory markers, which might be contributing to the disease process, as well as improve their physical function. So we were then going to set out on a series of studies to look at exercise dose. However, being pragmatic research within a dynamic health service, we had to pivot things around a little bit just because of things that were happening in our current rehab services at the time. So we ended up looking a little bit more at how we can get patients physically active using motivational interviewing. And how we got to that point was we did a series of studies. So after we did the review about exercise dose, we wanted to find out how active people coming into oncology rehab were and what kind of exercise intensity they do. And we found, unsurprisingly, that people with cancer are very inactive. They were completing, I think, around 10 minutes a day. It was something really low, and only there was only 4 patients out of our cohort of, I think, 46 in that study who actually could meet recommended physical activity targets. So then we thought, how are we going to get these people more active? And so we did a randomized controlled trial where we looked at just doing a standard cancer rehab program. And then we also added in our intervention group, cancer rehab plus dedicated motivational interviewing, which is a counseling technique that facilitates patients thinking about their own reasons why they want to improve their behavior. So in this case, it was physical activity. So we hypothesized that by giving motivational interviewing as well as just doing exercise in a rehab group, that that would help them become more active. But unfortunately, it didn't.
How often has the motivational speaks have been?
Yeah, so patients receive 2 phone calls a week. No, sorry. Patients received 1 phone call a week in addition to their 2 times a week training. So these phone calls went for about 20 minutes, half an hour, just depending on the patient and what they wanted to talk about. And that was for a period of 7 weeks.
So you found out that the motivational interviews didn't have like an influence on the amount of physical activity.
That's right.
I see. So what do you say, what are main burdens for patients with cancer, especially when they need to come to the hospital?
Yeah, so there are a lot of factors that influence their ability to be physically active. And a big one is just the effect of the side effects and where people are in their treatment cycle. And so sometimes people just don't have enough energy to even answer the phone, let alone to think about doing gym exercise, even though gym exercise is probably the best thing that they can do for that. And also just environmental barriers in terms of being able to get to a facility that they can do exercise. So our cancer rehab program that we ran was at one of our hospital sites, which is great for people who are living nearby that hospital, but not so great for people living far away. So that was a big issue, as well as paying for parking. So all of our hospitals in pretty much any metropolitan city in Australia, you will have to pay a fortune for parking. And these patients have so many medical appointments that they have to get to, and they're always at the hospital that they have to pay for parking. And so it's just a real juggle with the financial constraints, going to other appointments, feeling like rubbish. And our system just isn't set up to support patients to exercise.
And how did you set up the motivational interviews? Like, how did you try to motivate them? What did you told them?
Yeah, so the key with motivational interviewing is it's actually not us telling patients to do anything. So with motivational interviewing, we have to really sit back and listen, but at the same time, talk to patients in a way that gets them thinking about their own reasons for change. So we will only offer advice if a patient gives us permission to do so. So for example, we would be having a conversation. It's very important to engage and build rapport with a patient. So find out about their life, their activities, what their goals and what their values are. You know, do they want to get back to playing with the grandkids, which is quite a common one that patients will talk about? Or do they want to return to golf? And then as the weeks progress, we slowly build more motivational interviewing elements into that. So we will often ask about their importance to do physical activity, and we might ask them on a scale from 0 to 10. So 0 is it's not at all important, and 10 is completely important. And then the trick with motivational interviewing is that even if they say it's a 3 out of 10, instead of saying, oh, why isn't it a 10? You would say, why is it a 3 and not a 0? Yeah. And so by framing the question in that way, they'll start talking about all the positive reasons that put them as a 3 as opposed to a 0. And so we might then also ask about confidence. And then we will link their values and their hobbies and what they want to achieve to physical activity and their past experiences with physical activity. So it's really a skill to be able to evoke that change in people, and it is a long process, but it's not as time-consuming as clinicians often think it is.
So did the clinicians make the motivational interviews?
Yeah, so I actually did the motivational interviews and I was working as a clinician at the same time. So I had a unique situation where I was working with these patients in the rehab group, and then for 50% of the patients, I also got to counsel them once a week further in relation to their physical activity.
I see. So it might be a bit more, or is there a correlation between people love to do sports or being physical active before and before the diagnosis, and even though they want to like aiming and have more goals to be more active during the diagnosis?
Yeah, so definitely, and that's where a lot of the research has come from. So a lot of research that's been done in the oncology space is with people who have previously used to exercise. They know how to exercise, they know it's good for them, and they want to do something. So they'll enroll in exercise trials, and then these trials have positive results. And the difference with my research is that because we're doing it within the hospital with a real world sample of patients, you do have those patients that are very motivated, and whatever you tell them, they'll soak it up and they'll run with it and go and do their own exercise. But then a large proportion of our patients have never exercised before. And the only reason they're coming to my exercise program is because their oncologist told them to do it. Or they got repeated messaging from various people in their healthcare team that exercise is good for them. And so cancer is often referred to as a teachable moment, where someone might not have ever thought about exercise before, but a cancer diagnosis is such a threat to someone's mortality that they want to do whatever they can to be better and whatever they can to control this cancer. Because I remember a quote once from one of my ladies with breast cancer. She was like, I'm losing my hair, I feel sick, I had all these things happening to me and I had no control, but exercise is the one thing that I can control. And so that's why exercise in this setting is really powerful and can have benefits for people who have never exercised before. But it's still hard.
Yeah, sure. So you said that you're trying to find out about the doses of physical activity, and you said that mostly it is low intensity to moderate intensity, but did you try kind of high intensity training on your rehab program, or how did you
went with that? So at the time of doing my research, there hadn't been a lot of studies that had looked at high intensity exercise, a few more that had looked at more higher intensity strength training. But just to clarify, it's moderate intensity, not the low to moderate that is recommended. And then some guidelines came out in 2019 that again reinforced moderate intensity exercise. And then we have actually had trials done where they have looked at HIIT training in people with cancer, so specific cohorts. So particularly I remember there's a really good study that was done with people with colorectal cancer. Also in breast cancer, there's been some high intensity studies. And it is a type of exercise that for prehabilitation has been potentially quite useful for. So people that are preparing for cancer surgery, but they might only have 2-3 weeks for their surgery, we're testing high intensity exercise in that cohort and seeing what the results are. So there does seem to be some positive benefits of high intensity exercise, but I think this is for specific patient cohorts because a lot of patients that I see in our rehab program, they've got other comorbidities, particularly even things like musculoskeletal comorbidities. They might have heart disease. They might have comorbid respiratory conditions, and it's not safe for them to do HIIT exercise. But, you know, you might have your 40-year-old woman with breast cancer who used to do CrossFit, which I have had one of those patients. Yeah, she's medically stable. She can gradually build up to doing high intensity exercise. So it's about individualizing the exercise to your patient's needs.
So what could be maybe then the negative impacts if they do too high intensity training in their health status?
So with any exercise, there's always risks involved, and particularly in this population, they can be a little bit more vulnerable than other populations. So we obviously need to be mindful that we are not going to cause a cardiac event. Many of these patients, particularly patients on cardiotoxic chemotherapies, so a lot of our hematology cohort, our women with breast cancer, the cardiotoxicity causes changes in things like blood pressure, heart rate variability, etc. And they might be more tachycardic at rest than a standard patient with chronic disease that comes in. So that's something that you might need to consider in terms of exercise load. Someone who comes in with a resting heart rate of 95, I'm probably not going to be putting on an exercise bike to do HIIT training with. So that's one of the main things. Our patients are also often immunocompromised. So if they are currently receiving chemotherapy, we need to keep an eye on their blood levels. So certainly if someone is neutropenic, where their white blood cell count is low, we're not going to be getting them to do high intensity exercise and putting more stress on their already compromised immune system. So there's certain factors that we need to take extra care with. Also, patients with advanced disease might have bony metastases. So again, we're not going to be doing high intensity lifting loads anywhere near where that bony met is, because there is a risk that they might fracture. But if someone has only bony mets in their lower limbs, doesn't mean we can't do higher intensity strength training, at least with their upper limb. But there are definitely considerations that we need to be wary of when we're prescribing exercise to ensure it's safe. And when it is done that way by a health professional like a physio who is trained, exercise is very safe for this particular patient population, which again, people didn't think it was in the past.
So why do you think that maybe the guidelines trying to recommend only like moderate intensity? So do you think there's a reason why they come up with that?
So basically that's just based on the best level of evidence that we have at this point in time. Mm. So I can't believe it's already 4 years since those updated guidelines were released. And with those guidelines, we really did try and provide clinicians with a more specific dose. But again, a lot of the research at that time, they did this massive review, which I think had like 1,000 papers, still found that I think most of the studies are being done in a moderate intensity population or a low intensity. There are not as many in a high intensity population. So perhaps when we have our next iteration of guidelines, perhaps in another 10 years, there might be more recommendations for higher intensity exercise. But another key part of the guidelines is that exercise should be individualized. So a skilled clinician will know when to do higher intensity exercise as opposed to just sticking with moderate intensity. And then in saying that, some patients can't even do moderate intensity. It's enough for them to just get to the gym and sit on a bike for 2 minutes and cycle. So the other part of the guidelines is any exercise is better than no exercise. Mm. So there is a certain degree of clinical judgment that still has to come within reading those guidelines. That's just a starting point.
Okay, yes, I see. That's very interesting. So thank you for that at first. So have you found any other results of your research in your PhD?
Yeah, so something that was kind of nice that came out of our qualitative work is that rehab is a place that patients feel like they can be normal. And the title of the paper of that is it's a good stepping stone to normality. So oncology rehab really can be a bridge into patients getting back into their everyday life, which is really great. And so all of the studies from my PhD resulted in us coming up with a framework of how we think we could potentially get more people active after cancer, but knowing that we have finite resources within hospital settings. So not every single person, unfortunately, can come to one of our fantastic, fun cancer rehab programs that's supervised by a physiotherapist and a nurse. And as you mentioned before, Sabrina, that we have quite a spectrum of patients. There might be people that can do high intensity that love exercise. So perhaps those patients don't need to come to the hospital to do their exercise training. Perhaps they can just see somebody out in the community, whether it be a trained fitness trainer or an exercise physiologist or a physiotherapist, have an assessment, get a program, and away they go. They feel confident, and then they can have check-ins every now and then. But then there are other people at the other end of the spectrum, your 80-year-old lady with metastatic cancer that walks with a four-wheel frame. She might even need one-on-one rehab. So we developed the CARE framework, the Cancer Rehabilitation to Recreation framework, that explains that there are three main phases of rehabilitation, I suppose, after a cancer diagnosis, and that depending on what their physical function is, the level of their side effects, and also their confidence to exercise, that will determine which service is most appropriate for what person. So it's a theoretical framework that's based on a couple of other models that have come from just chronic disease in general, but also some other cancer-related rehab models as well, which we amalgamated and put directly with a focus on physical activity. So we're yet to test that framework, but it does provide us with a bit of a basis of how we might determine who goes to what service to ensure that people can be as active as they can be after diagnosis.
So you have developed some cooperations with some services from the hospital, or is it like you have to implement them, or are they already here in the hospital?
Yeah, so unfortunately, there is still a lack of services, and that's why it is a little bit difficult to test the framework. So we do seem to have quite a few services in cancer rehab. It's getting better than when I did my PhD in 2015. So one of the studies from my PhD was that we found that there were only 31 programs in Australia that could provide cancer rehab, specific cancer exercise rehab. And that would be enough to service only one in 200 cancer survivors. Mm-hmm. And in Australia, we have at least 500,000 cancer survivors that are within 5 years of their diagnosis. So still not very good access. And I think that number might have increased to double that. And we're about to do another study next year to see how that has changed over the last nearly 10 years. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a lot of services there. In the community, we have a workforce of 36,000 physios, about 5,000 exercise physiologists, but they lack confidence in prescribing exercise to people with cancer still. Mm-hmm. So another part of the next phase of my research is trying to upskill those clinicians so they do feel confident to deliver programs out in the community. And then I think there's the third level, which is also going into gyms and teaching fitness trainers how they can supervise people with cancer as well, perhaps for more those higher level patients or people who have come through a rehab program. So then people feel safe to integrate back into their community and do their sport and gym like they used to. And definitely overseas, there's a program called ACE, the Alberta Cancer Exercise Program, where they've done a really nice job at upskilling their trainers in their local communities to be able to deliver exercise. And I think that pilot, they got like 2,000 people or something like that through their program. But an issue is a lot of it is philanthropically funded. There's not a lot of investment at a public health service level from our department to be able to implement these programs. So one issue is a lot of these programs start off because we get a grant from somewhere or a charity and we'll give us some philanthropic funding, but it's only a finite amount of money. And to be able to continue to give these programs long term, we need a longer term investment through our health services. So that's one of the major challenges that we have to being able to provide these kinds of services.
Oh, it's a big challenge.
It is.
So maybe I can jump back to the theoretical framework you told about. And did you make like an analysis before about the socioeconomic happening about the health service here in Australia maybe or in general to know about, yeah, that the access is quite difficult?
So we haven't analysed with my work in terms of health economics stuff, and we haven't delved deeply into socioeconomic status of patients, although there's other research groups that have demonstrated that there are big disparities in the amount of access to even just allied health services in general between people living in rural and remote areas, and particularly Australia. It's a massive country, and I actually have a PhD student at the moment who's doing some work on being able to increase access to services in regional areas, and he's based in the southern part of Western Australia, so we'll hopefully come up with some strategies for that cohort, and telehealth is a great option potentially for them. But at a health service level, there's been a little bit of research that is being done looking at whether there's benefits of providing exercise and rehab for these patients and whether it stops them coming back into hospital, and whether if they are in hospital, whether they have a shorter length of stay. But the jury is really out. So again, in some cohorts, there are benefits. So we know definitely in lung cancer, if you can provide a preoperative exercise program, they're likely to spend about 2 days less in hospital. Again, people with advanced cancer, we just did a systematic review, and if they do palliative rehab, are less likely to be readmitted to hospital and will spend about 1.8 days less in hospital. And it might sound small, but when a hospital stay for 1 day costs, say, $2,000 a day, if you multiply that by 3,000 patients that are coming through our doors every year, that's massive savings for the health service.
Does it as well have an influence on the health of the patients, though, even they have less days in the hospital.
That's exactly right. And what we did find with that systematic review with people with advanced diseases is that even though they were less time in hospital, it wasn't at the expense of their quality of life. So they still had better quality of life, even though they were spending less time in hospital. So it is a win-win for both patients.
And maybe how could we see or explain that if there would be more access to in-health services and the patients, when they come into the hospital and are less motivated before. So you know what I wanted to ask? How's the lag between when they have access and still not being motivated to do any physical activity?
Yeah, so it's really tricky. So we did another study called the CanFit study, where we thought, you know, patients are coming into hospital, they don't have a lot of things to do on the ward. While some patients, you know, they're having investigations and they're quite sick, we do have a cohort of patients that come onto our oncology ward, and particularly our hematology patients that might be coming in for planned chemotherapy. They have to hang around for 3-4 weeks, or patients coming in for a stem cell transplant, and you know, in the period preparing for their transplant, and then towards the end of their stay, they're just in hospital because they're being monitored, but otherwise are quite fit and well. So we thought that we could help them be more physically active while they're on the hospital ward. Again, it's another teachable moment for people, but we did find it was really hard to implement this study because patients still lacked a little bit of motivation because they felt sick. And that's really understandable. So the last thing they kind of feel like is then getting up and exercising. And also the patients that were on the ward at the time of doing the study, they were really unwell. So there was a high proportion of patients who actually just weren't even medically stable to do exercise, which meant we could only capture a very small cohort of patients to be able to give them some Fitbits to wear. We got a physio to come around and tell them about the guidelines and make a step count and a goal. And the patients that did get the intervention, they actually did quite appreciate it, and it was good for them to have, again, that sense of control, something that they could focus on each day, try and walk a little bit more. But because of the medical instability of these patients, it was kind of hard to maintain on the time that we were monitoring them on the ward and things like that. So just handing out Fitbits on a ward in theory was a really good idea, but it was really hard to do the research to be able to implement it. So I think in the future, if we're going to be doing research with people who are admitted to hospital, we need to be a bit more creative about the study designs that we use and having the whole ward be involved in the implementation of that. And the other thing I should also mention is that running these trials, and it's happened both in my inpatient trials and my outpatient trials, patients really want to be in the intervention group. And then they get really sad when they're not. So that's always difficult as well.
You pointed out that the feeling of self-control is very important. So I asked myself whether there may be other kind of intervention which must actually not include physical activity as soon as they got a feeling of self-control. So it might be an important thing that they feel of, that they feel self-controlled.
And it can be, in anything. It doesn't have to be, you know, physical activity related.
Do you think it would maybe motivate them in general in hospital stay, and then maybe motivate them in physical activity?
Yeah, that's right. And like, I'd love to kind of see, and I don't think we've analysed the results yet, but we did track our patients who were in hospital for then 1 month after their discharge to see if their physical activity behaviour is different between the ones that received the intervention and the control group. But I don't have those results yet. But I think, again, in theory, I think we do motivate patients, because even another study that we did We ran a prehab study of people who were having an autologous stem cell transplant. So this is a really like major procedure where patients get heavy doses of chemo, and then their stem cells get taken out and spun around and put back into them to essentially cure their blood cancer. And these patients spend a lot of time in hospital. And in our control group, we had to, at least from an ethical point of view, give them physical activity advice, like standard advice with the guidelines. And the intervention group, they got like intensive home-based exercise. They were doing weights. They were walking with the therapists, like a lot. And what our stem cell transplant nurse noted was that when patients were coming onto the ward, even the patients that were in the control group, they were actually up walking laps of the ward, and they actually were asking about exercise and whether they could get up and walk. And that was a completely different culture to, say, 6 or 12 months beforehand, where patients, they're in hospital, they're a bit institutionalized, yeah, and they don't want to do anything. So obviously just even having that conversation with a physio, which they had to because of the research, was enough to kind of change their mindset a little bit in terms of physical activity.
That's nice. And yeah, sometimes in research field it can be lost as the subject of clinical study are patients. So how do you make sure to include the patient's experience from the study, like, or in general of their health and sickness, how they experience it?
Yeah, so I think the advantage with the type of research and any of the research that we do in our clinical research office is most of us researchers are clinicians. So we know kind of how to listen and take on board feedback and talk to our patients in a way that makes them feel included and that they're not just a research subject.
Yeah.
And it's actually almost an issue for my research because a lot of our patients treat it as like a physiotherapy service, and they might forget. We tell them, you know, don't tell us what group that you're in because, you know, we need to be blind for the research. And then they might accidentally tell you, oh, I've been doing this great exercise group, and then unblind themselves. Yeah, so I think we're really good at listening, and we do a lot of qualitative research. So my studies are always being built on the stuff that the patients in the study beforehand have told me. And we've also started using more and more co-design, which has increasingly become popular in research, especially here in Australia. And it's built into our National Health and Medical Research Council. We have a framework for including consumers in our research. And it's almost expected now that you will have a consumer or a patient on committees that are informing how the research is delivered, and that the design of the intervention is something that they actually need. And then that hopefully translates into research that will be more readily translated into a hospital setting. Although the research on that is still more qualitative rather than, you know, having trials that studies using co-design resulted in projects that were translated better. But I think that's also part of the research. It's not in its infancy. It's been around for a while, but I think it's only now that people are really understanding the importance of doing patient-centered research using co-design principles.
So it sounds like you have a lot to do in the future, and still you are in many researchers involved, which is really great. So just to finish off, do you have another ideas already?
Yes, I have so many ideas. So I suppose where my research is heading is looking at different models of rehabilitation to optimize the access for our patients. So one of my main studies that I've been doing in my fellowship the last 3 years has been using telehealth since COVID, obviously, where we did online group exercise classes for people with cancer. And so again, while it's quite a simple kind of intervention and theory, it hasn't robustly been tested. And we haven't looked at the quantitative data yet, but certainly the qualitative results are really promising that this is an intervention that will expand the reach of cancer rehab to people who might not be able to get to a hospital, whether it be physical location or just because they feel too sick. They're still happy to log on to Zoom if they feel really tired, but they wouldn't want to get in the car to get to a hospital program.
So maybe you can explain, there are like, is there someone who's going to make the video or the Zoom call? What is the call actually about?
Yeah, that's right. So we'd set up exactly like an exercise class in person. We had a physio, we had an allied health assistant who would sit in the background as the second person just in case there was any safety issues. And everyone got their own individualized program, but they were in a small group on Zoom, and the physio would tailor the exercise to their needs on Zoom. And that would be twice a week for 8 weeks, like a standard kind of circuit training program. So because it looks like that intervention is potentially working, we want to then roll that program out beyond just our hospital. So some of the main things that I'm thinking of putting together next is, first of all, within our hospital, we're going to integrate that program into our existing community health service to ensure that it continues in the long term. And our community health service managers have committed to supporting this program into the future, and they already have staff that are trained to be able to deliver that. So we will look at doing that, as well as doing some training programs and teaching physios and exercise physiologists how to deliver this program in their clinic, so more people know how to deliver this package of exercise to people with cancer. And we also have a website called the Cancer Exercise Toolkit. So if you are interested in wanting to set up a program like this yourself, there's lots of really great resources on there about what exercise dose, what the safety considerations are, some patient handouts for people. It is Australia-centric, but we have had people from all over the world access that website. So we want to be able to update that to include some of our telehealth resources as well. So that's just a snapshot of some of the things that we'd like to do in terms of taking the next steps. And my main goal is that I want to be able to evaluate our carer framework that I was talking about before. Really test whether having a physio in a cancer center or hospital and having patients come through and them getting triaged to the service that they need, whether that is an effective and an efficient way of delivering care. So that is a few ideas that I have.
So is there something else you want to tell the listeners?
Yeah, so I think just this is a really exciting space to work in, both clinically and do research in. So if you are interested in doing research, I know in Germany in particular, they're probably maybe more advanced than we are. A lot of research came out of Germany in the early days about exercise and people with cancer. So I would reach out to some of those researchers, or if you're interested in coming to Australia, you can get in contact with me. Check out our Cancer Exercise Toolkit website and, you know, see how you go. But I think one of the main things for people particularly who might be studying kinesiology or human movement or wanting to get into clinical sciences like physiotherapy or occupational therapy, cancer is a really rewarding space to work in. And people think that it might be a really sad area to work in, but whenever people ask me that, I think that it's not sad at all. And it's the most rewarding area of my physiotherapy practice, because the patients that we work with, they just want to get better, and we actually help them get better, and we can see those improvements. So it really is an area where you can make a difference. So if you're thinking of doing something a little bit left of center and not necessarily going down the sports route, which is what a lot of people do. I went into physiotherapy thinking I would be a sports physiotherapist. I would never have dreamed that I'd end up in oncology, but it's definitely a very rewarding direction that I've taken that I will continue to work in because there's so many opportunities in this area. So yeah, give it a go.
Oh, so thank you so much for your thoughts, Amy. And thank you as well for joining this podcast and sharing your resources to support people with cancer in terms of exercise. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hinweis. Denjenigen, die uns nun schon länger begleiten, wird unser neues Intro aufgefallen sein. Dabei handelt es sich um das Stück Overture to a New Age von Jan Dehaan. Es wurde vom Symphonischen Blasorchester des Collegium Musicum der Goethe-Universität unter Leitung von Lisa Bodem eingespielt. An dieser Stelle einen herzlichen Dank an alle daran Beteiligten für die Unterstützung.